This is now talk number 51 in the series on the wicked. We're coming to the last overall section or theme in the series now. And what I want to do here is to look at the big and broad subject of dealing with witchcraft and curses. And this, however, can only be a very brief introduction to these two very big subjects, because they will take a lot of dealing with, because they're such enormous subjects, and they're to be found right throughout the Bible, and there's so much to say about them, not only biblically but also in terms of unwrapping that and explaining that and giving illustrations and examples of that. And it's a huge subject. So, but what I want to do in these five talks that I'm going to do on witchcraft and curses is just introduce these themes and begin to look at them, because we shall need to look at them later. And in particular, what I'm going to be doing is in book 7 I shall be looking at the world, the flesh and the devil, and I shall touch upon these themes in that. In book 9, demonology, I shall be looking at demonology and deliverance and so forth, and that we'll be looking at this subject again from another angle in that book. But later than that, I'm intending to write a book on the whole subject of spiritual warfare, and again we shall look at this subject from further angles and different, look at different aspects of it. So it's a huge topic, but this is just an introduction. I hasten to make that clear. So let me begin by just giving a few verses, and I could have given dozens of these, but here are some in which these themes of witchcraft and cursing and so on are spoken of in the Bible, and I want to read out a few of them and just make a few brief points before we begin. But my key purpose in doing this as an introduction to this talk is just to highlight the fact that curses and blessings and witchcraft and so forth are entirely real. They're not imaginary, they're not just all in the mind, as so many people, even in churches, fully assume. So it's very widely assumed that when someone is involved in witchcraft, they're just it's just make-believe, they're just pretending to do things. It has no effect, it has no meaning, it has no power, that nothing's really happening, the person's just imagining things. Well, that's what many, many believe. What I would seek to suggest to you is that there's no basis for saying that in the Bible. None whatever. The Bible takes witchcraft and cursing and all sorts of associated themes and points associated with these things entirely seriously. The Bible assumes them to be real and gives us no basis whatsoever for thinking that they're not real. So that belief, or rather that casual assumption, is an entirely man-made one. There's no biblical basis for holding that view or for failing to take these things seriously. Just a man-made belief, or a tradition you might say, that's been passed on and that is taught in many churches, but which is not biblical. Okay, so let's just look at a few. So in Numbers 24 verse 9, the second part of that verse, it says, "Blessed be everyone who blesses you, and cursed be everyone who curses you." Now that's speaking about the Jewish people. But the brief point I would make is, why would God use either of these words, blessing and cursing, if neither of them had any real meaning or effect? Why would God be using words that aren't real, don't mean anything, don't actually exist? The concept being spoken of within the word doesn't exist. Well, why would God use these phrases? Why would God say that he wants people to be cursed if they curse the Jewish people, if it isn't possible to be cursed, or if there's no such thing as a curse, or a curse has no effect, it has no meaning, it has no reality? God doesn't just use meaningless, pointless, purposeless words. The words that he uses have meaning and they're real. Okay, let's look briefly at Isaiah chapter 47 verse 9, and it's the second part of that verse, because I'm just zeroing in on these particular words. I'm not wanting to look into the wider context just for the moment. So it says here, "In spite of your many sorceries And that's an aspect of witchcraft. And the great power of your enchantments. And again, that's another aspect of witchcraft, the casting of spells and so on. Now the thing is, here Isaiah is speaking, and of course he's speaking under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, but he uses the word sorceries, and he says nothing to imply that it has no purpose, effect or meaning. The clear implication is that it's something he takes very seriously. But also, in particular, the explicit words that are stated at the latter part of that sect, that line, says, and the great power of your enchantments. Now, what do you make of those words? If someone's going to say that enchantments or the casting of spells has no effect, has no power, has no reality, has no meaning, it's not real, well, what on earth is Isaiah talking about? How can Isaiah say that enchantments have great power if they don't have great power, or if they don't have any power? And so, again, we just have to keep looking through the Bible and actually opening our eyes and seeing what the Bible says. And in so many places and in so many ways, it says the opposite of what so many of us assume and what so many of us have been taught to think and taught to believe. All right, well, here's another one from Galatians. This is Apostle Paul speaking in Galatians 3, verse 1, and it's the first part of that verse. And it says, O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? And then Paul goes on to elaborate on that, but all I'm interested in is these words, who has bewitched you? Now, remember, I've done a whole series on the letter to the Galatians, which I would refer you to, but essentially this point here is that Paul is saying that the Galatians and this whole confusion and error and wrong teaching that has been accepted and embraced, he's saying it has come about because the people have been bewitched. Effectively, their minds have been numbed and they've been rendered incapable of seeing the truth, rendered incapable of discerning, that their minds have been sort of switched off. Now, the thing is, when people look at that word bewitched, the general widespread assumption is that Paul doesn't mean that literally. It's just a non-literal figure of speech, and all Paul means is who has sort of had an influence upon you or something like that. Well, there is no reason to assume that it's a non-literal figure of speech. There's every reason to suppose that Paul means it entirely literally. So what he's saying is that the extent to which the people who believed these wrong teachings and these wrong ideas and who had wrong thinking in their heads, the extent to which that's the case in their lives is in part due to the fact that they've been literally bewitched. Now, what does bewitched mean? It means to have come under the power and influence of witchcraft, which we shall hopefully look into more closely. But it is it's a description of the people who have come under that power. So witchcraft is witchcraft, and bewitched means is a description of those people who are affected by it, influenced by it, controlled by it. And there's no reason at all to assume that Paul doesn't mean literally and precisely exactly what he's saying. When we see figures of speech in the Bible, then let's recognize them as such and accept them as such, of course. So when Jesus says that he's a door, then we know that's a figure of speech because we know that he isn't a door. But he is what that figure of speech is intended to mean and to convey. But here, when Paul says, who has bewitched you, there isn't any reason to suppose that that's a figure of speech. There's every reason to suppose that Paul means it literally. So, the next one, let's look at this, Proverbs 26, verse 2. It says, like a sparrow in its flitting, like a swallow in its flying, so a curse without cause does not alight. And again, I shall look at this more closely later, but essentially, just to make this point at the outset, one of the things that is true of curses and the degree to which, the extent to which they come upon people, have effect over people, that they land on a person, you might say, and affect their lives. The point is that One of the reasons why people have different levels of effect in their lives, it depends on the different factors that apply in their lives. So if there are causes in their lives which make a curse more able to land upon them, to affect them, to influence them, then it will. And if those causes don't exist or exist to a lesser extent, then the curse will either not apply or will apply only to a lesser extent. And so essentially there are curses all over the place. There are curses being uttered and curses being cast over people all the time, but some are more affected than others, and that's the point. It depends on the degree to which that person is open to or vulnerable to being cursed, and that in turn depends on the extent of things in their lives like sin or the occult or other things in their background, occult activity on the part of their parents or grandparents and so forth. The things they've said and done that render them more prone, more vulnerable than they would otherwise be. So that's an issue and a principle that we'll need to come back to. All right, then another verse or another passage from Deuteronomy 18, verses 10 to sort of 14. It says, "There shall not be found among you anyone who burns his son or his daughter as an offering, anyone who practices divination, a soothsayer, or an augur." An augur is a teller of the future. "Or a sorcerer, or a charmer, or a medium, or a wizard, or a necromancer." A necromancer is someone who seeks to contact the dead. "For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord. And because of these abominable practices, the Lord your God is driving them out before you." He's speaking here about the Canaanites. "You shall be blameless before the Lord your God, for these nations which you are about to dispossess give heed to soothsayers and to diviners as fortune tellers. But as for you, the Lord your God has not allowed you so to do." Okay, now, in brief, why would God consider these various things which are listed in that passage to be an abomination or abominable practices if they weren't real, or if they had no effect, or if they were of no significance? So let's imagine that these things were simply a waste of time, or were simply something that God didn't want done because it was useless or a waste of time. I don't know, some sport or useless activity that was did no good, but then again did no harm. Playing badminton or something. Let's imagine God didn't want you to play badminton because he thought it was a waste of time. Not that he does, but imagine that was the case. It was an entirely harmless activity. Well, how could it be classed as an abomination or an abominable practice? God would simply describe it as something I don't want you to do, something I don't want you to waste time on, something that's not productive, not useful. There are better things for you to be spending your time doing than playing bingo or, I don't know, wasting time on Facebook, etc. So God wouldn't say that Facebook is an abomination or Twitter is an abomination, not in and of itself. Even though there are some things on it that are. So the thing is, what we're saying here is that these practices are considered by God to be inherently abominable, an abomination. That's really at the top end of the spectrum in terms of God's dislike for and objection to these practices. So evidently, it is not simply that people are wasting their time on these things, or, you know, they're less than ideal things to be doing, or they're completely imaginary things that don't really exist, and people are just wasting their time on them. Plainly, that's not what God thinks. God thinks these things are an abomination and abominable practices because they're real. That's why he takes them seriously, because they're serious, they're real, they have an effect. And that doesn't emerge only from that passage, but from all the other dozens and dozens of passages where this subject is addressed and its seriousness is emphasized and its reality is plainly apparent. Okay, well, again, in 2 Chronicles 33 verse 6, just briefly, it says, "And he burned his sons as an offering in the valley of the son of Hinnom, and practiced soothsaying and augury and sorcery, and dealt with mediums and with wizards. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger." So evidently God thinks that those things are evil. So plainly he wasn't simply wasting his time on useless activities that served no purpose. These things are inherently evil, and God would not call them that if they were nondescript, unimportant things. They're plainly very important. Okay, and all right, another one. 2 Kings 9 verse 22. "Now it happened when Joram saw Jehu that he said, 'Is it peace, Jehu?' So he answered, 'What peace, as long as the harlotries of your mother Jezebel and her witchcraft are so many?" Now, we spoke of this in an earlier talk about the way in which King Jehu tackled head-on the witchcraft of the family line of Ahab and Jezebel and wiped them out. And he did so because God commanded him to do so. He was instructed to do it. It wasn't Jehu's idea. It was God's idea. God wanted it done and praised Jehu for doing it. Now, why would God be so concerned about Jezebel's witchcraft if it was all purely imaginary, just in her mind, just all, you know, her, she was just playing with dolls' houses and toys and it didn't mean nothing? It was all just imaginary games that she was playing. Why would God be so bothered about it? Why would God take it so seriously if it wasn't real? And so, okay, let's keep going. Micah chapter 5 verse 12, it says, "I will destroy your witchcraft, and you will no longer cast spells." Okay, well, again, the same point. Why does God want to destroy witchcraft if it's an activity that's innocuous and harmless and meaningless and imaginary? And why does God say that they'll no longer cast spells if they weren't casting spells? And why would God want them to stop casting spells if casting spells didn't matter, had no effect, had no meaning, had no significance? Why would God draw attention to it? Why would God take it so seriously if these things weren't real? And again, I could go on and on all day with this, but I'm not going to. Let me just give a few more. In the book of Nahum, chapter 3, verse 4, it says, "All because of the wanton lust of a prostitute, alluring the mistress of sorceries, who enslaved nations by her prostitution and peoples by her witchcraft." Okay, well, how could these nations and peoples be enslaved by witchcraft if witchcraft wasn't real and had no power and had no effect and had no meaning, just imaginary? How can a nation or a people be enslaved by something that's not there? And so, to me, the point is, it's just overwhelmingly obvious. But as with so many overwhelmingly obvious points, they're not obvious to people. And they, at any rate, they're not taught, they're not believed, they're not taken seriously, even though they ought to be. Okay. I've got several more in book 6, which I've given, but I'm not going to give them all. Here's another one from Acts chapter 8, verses 9 to 11. It says, "But there was a certain man called Simon, who previously practiced sorcery in the city, and astonished the people of Samaria, claiming that he was someone great, to whom they all gave heed from the least to the greatest, saying, 'This man is the great power of God.' And they heeded him," that means they listened to him, "because he had astonished them with his sorceries for a long time." Now, how could this man, Simon, astonish the people with his sorcery if his sorcery wasn't real and had no effect, had no power, Nothing really happened. It was all imagined. It doesn't follow, does it? Plainly, what he was doing was real. Now, the mere fact that a practice is invalid and sinful, and that it doesn't come from God, and that it comes from demons, that doesn't mean that it isn't real. It just means that it isn't good, that it isn't lawful, it isn't appropriate, it isn't valid. But the mere fact that something isn't good, lawful, valid, appropriate, doesn't mean that it isn't real. None of that follows. It's simply a complete non sequitur. It's a foolish argument to think that these things aren't real. And also, I would just remind you, remember Janis and Jambres in Egypt, the occult practitioners who worked for Pharaoh at the time of Moses and the time of the plagues. Now, they were able to match all the miracles and plagues of Moses until at least it came to producing gnats, but they produced the others. And there was nothing special about gnats as such. It's just that God, at that point, said, "No, enough's enough. I'm not going to let you match my servant Moses in regard to these." So they were not allowed to use their power in relation to gnats, but they were for the other things. And what we can deduce from that account of Janis and Jambres, and what they plainly did, is that they were actually using magic power, demonic, satanic power, to create all these different plagues, just as Moses was using God's power to do it. And the thing is, we've got to realize Satan and the demons have a lot of power. That doesn't mean they have complete power, but the mere fact that they don't have complete power is not a basis for saying that they have no power. There are places in between the North Pole and the South Pole, so the fact that something isn't at the North Pole doesn't mean that it must therefore be at the South Pole, do you see? And so the fact that they don't have complete power does not mean that they have no power. They have power, and they just plainly, self-evidently do. And the Bible gives us no basis for thinking that Janis and Jambres were just pretending to do these miracles, or that the people just imagined that they did these miracles. It's quite clear from the account in Exodus that they did do these things. That's not even in question. They plainly did. Of course, in the end, God exalts and vindicates Moses by causing Moses to be the only one to be allowed to carry on doing the miracles. And then, of course, Moses' rod is cast down, and he eats the rods of the snakes of the occult practitioners. Yeah, that all happens, of course. But the thing is, they cast their rods down as well, and they became snakes. It's just that Moses' snake ate their snakes. But the thing is, the fact that Moses had more power because he was operating in God's power doesn't mean that they had no power. It just means they had less power. And we'd be foolish to suppose that they had no power at all, and that if we were up against Janis and Jambres, we could just assume that these men were just hallucinating fantasists who have no real power, they just imagine they do. There's simply no basis for that. And if you were to take that view, you'd actually be putting yourself in significant danger by being so foolishly complacent. Okay. Well, let's just carry on with one or two more. So in Revelation chapter 2, verse 24, it says, "But I say to you, the rest who are in Thyatira, who do not hold this teaching, who have not known the deep things of Satan, as they call them, I place no other burden on you." Now, all I'm wanting to focus on is these words, "the deep things of Satan." Now, Satan has power, and there are things about Satan that many people don't know. There are many things about the devil and about demons that are not known to people, even to people who read the Bible, because they don't take it seriously, they don't look at it, they don't consider it, they don't place any time thinking, any emphasis on it, don't spend any time thinking about it. And for that reason, many of us don't know the deep things of Satan. I don't purport to know everything about Satan, far from it. But I know that he's real, I know he has power, I know that his servants, the demons, are real and have power. And I don't purport to know everything and understand everything, but I know that. And I know I need to take them seriously, I know I need to resist them. and I know that I need to know as much about their activities as I can in order to defend myself and others from their activities. I know that. Okay, so Revelation 9, verse 21. It says, "And they did not repent of their murders, or their sorceries, or their sexual immorality, or their thefts." Now, why do we take literally murder, sexual immorality, and theft, and think that those things are real, and that those things are important, but not take seriously sorcery, or assume that sorcery isn't real? Why would we single out sorcery for assuming that it's not real, when the other things are real? And then in Revelation 18, verse 23, the second part of that verse, it says, "And all nations were deceived by thy sorcery." Now, how could this sorcery of the Antichrist and the false prophet and so on, how could that deceive all nations if it wasn't real, if it didn't have power? Plainly, if something is capable of deceiving all the nations, if that activity or that process or that power is sufficient to achieve that outcome, then clearly it's not something that's insubstantial or imaginary. Obviously, whatever it is, and whatever the precise extent of that power, it's plainly large and real and very worrying. So we have no basis for assuming that the power of the Antichrist is just imaginary or just trivial or insignificant. Clearly, it's not. It's massive. The power of Satan is massive. The power of the demons is very, very great. And we need to take them seriously. But, I mean, we can see it even now. Never mind when the Antichrist comes. Even now we see our generation degenerating, descending into the most extraordinary foolishness and blindness and stupidity. Levels of stupidity that have never been seen on the face of the earth before, except possibly at the time of the flood. But the things that are being done now, the politicians that we're electing, the good people that we're rejecting, look at the way that Ted Cruz has recently been rejected by the American people, and that they are seeking to elect either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. Now, if they had set out to have a competition to find the most appalling people to stand for president, and if they were saying, let's choose the most terrible, wicked, sinful, devious, deceitful, ungodly people that we can find in America. Now those two, Clinton and Trump, would surely have been in the top 10 or the top 100 in the whole of the United States. If they were trying to find the worst people, they'd have been in there with a good shout if that was the aim. So how can it be that a great nation like America would narrow it down to choosing between those two utter charlatans, fraudsters and as terrible people as that? And how could they reject people like Ted Cruz? And I think the answer is that the people in America are bewitched. Their minds are numbed. Their minds are switched off. They can't understand. They can't see. They can't see why Donald Trump is a charlatan and a fraudster and a crook and a con man. They can't see it. And indeed, many people in churches are even thinking that he's going to be Cyrus, that God's calling him. And it's complete nonsense. It's an utter deception and a delusion. The only extent to which you could say that Donald Trump is being called or used or empowered by God or authorized by God is to operate as a judgment on America. That's not to say that you should be voting for him. The point is that where a man comes as a judgment of God on a nation, that doesn't mean that God wants you to want him or wants you to support him. It means that God allows him to come as a judgment on America for its sin and its wickedness, in particular with regard to abortion, which is absolutely terrible, but also many other things, sexual promiscuity, the abandonment of Christianity, the abandonment of marriage, the prevalence of divorce, the great rise in homosexual practice and also in gender confusion, and just on and on the list goes. America is falling apart. So Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton being now the final two candidates left for Democrat and Republican, does not mean that God is raising them up because he approves of them. It means, the only thing it can be said to mean in that context is that God is permitting them to come forward as a judgment. Okay, but anyway, the relevance of that is this, that people can be blinded. People can be deceived. Whole nations, or large parts thereof, can be blinded and deceived by witchcraft, just as Paul spoke of in relation to the church in Galatia. Alright, so those are just a few points by way of a preamble before I enter into this first talk on witchcraft and cursing. And please bear in mind, I could have gone on all day giving other verses, other passages, in which these themes and these phrases are taken seriously and considered to be real. Okay, so the first thing we look at now is, why do we need to be aware of the power of witchcraft? Why do we even need to talk about this? And I say that because the vast majority of church leaders don't talk about this. So why am I talking about it? Why do you need to know about it? Well, this chapter that I put into book 6 and these 5 talks that I'm doing on this are there because witchcraft and curses are an integral part of how the wicked undermine you. These are concepts and themes and issues in themselves, witchcraft and curses, but they're also the weapons which the wicked use against you, and you need to understand them. So if we were wanting to oppose the Germans in World War II, we would want to understand their weaponry. We'd want to understand the features and specifications of the Messerschmitt 109 or the Tiger tank. We'd want to know how we can address or deal with a Tiger tank, and if we're up against it with a Sherman tank, what's the best way to tackle a Tiger tank? What's the best way to shoot down a Messerschmitt 109 or a Dornier or a Heinkel or any of these other things? We want to know that, wouldn't we? Well, equally, witchcraft and curses are the tools of the trade of the wicked and are used by them against you. And as I started this talk by saying, they're real, they're not imaginary. They're just as real as Messerschmitts and Tiger tanks and Dorniers and Heinkels and Stuka dive bombers and you name it. Those are real things, and these are real things too. And we need to understand how the wicked operate, what do they do, how do they do it, what do they use, how do they use it, how does it work, how can we counteract it, how can we defend ourselves from it. Well, we certainly need to know all those things if we want to tackle the wicked more effectively. Now, in the earlier chapters in Book 6, I focused primarily on what you might call ordinary, pragmatic, practical steps that you need to take in dealing with the wicked as human beings, the people, the actual wicked people. And I've done so in the context of the workplace, the church, the family, and elsewhere. Practical steps you need to take against them as people, or to deal with them as people. But we also need to understand this dimension to things, and that is the extent to which those wicked people are operating in or being further empowered by these sources of power. And so, basically, this is a huge subject. And we need to deal with it, but we can't deal with it all in these 5 talks. It's just not possible, or just in this one chapter in Book 6, because it's a big, big subject, but also because it's so badly misunderstood by so many Christians, and therefore in addressing it, or in beginning to address it as I am, there is a lot that needs to be unlearned as well as things that need to be learned, because there are so many different things that Christians believe that they shouldn't believe and don't believe that they should believe, and definitions of words that they have got wrong or they've misunderstood, or assumptions that they're making they shouldn't be making, or traditions that they're accepting that they shouldn't be accepting, or aspects of the Bible that they should be believing that they're not believing, or that they're misunderstanding, and there's just so much work to do to unlearn and then to learn what the Bible actually says. So it's important. And even to begin to study curses and witchcraft, we'd need to spend a lot of time defining a lot of words and then going on to consider how we can defend ourselves from these things. So please, as we begin to look at this subject, albeit briefly, please don't assume that witchcraft can't possibly be real, or it doesn't need to be taken seriously, it can't possibly have any effect on us, because we're modern people, we're very scientific, therefore these silly things can't possibly have any effect on us. You know, these are just things that old-fashioned people believe in. You know, foolish and silly people like Moses and David and Paul and John and people like that. But obviously sensible people like us, we don't believe in these things. Please don't take that view. It's a really stupid view to take, and we need to take seriously the things that the writers of the Bible took seriously. And where there is a contradiction between what they said and did and what the modern church says and does, we need to take the side of the writers of the Bible, not the people whose traditions, church traditions, we've been brought up with and which we've hitherto embraced. Where those things don't tally, abandon your traditions and adopt what the Bible says. And that's true of this, and it's true of everything. It's true of every single theme or issue or point. Okay, well, let's begin by looking at a curse. What exactly is a curse? What do we mean by it? Now, that very word curse may conjure up in many people's minds images from Macbeth or from horror films of witches in pointy hats. When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain? And so on, all that kind of thing, from the opening to Macbeth, with cauldrons and, you know, ear of bat and eye of toad and all that stuff. But the reality about curses and witchcraft is much more mundane. Curses, if you boil it down to its basic level, what is a curse? I would say this: it's a negative word spoken by a person which harms, hinders, or blights the life of some other person or group. Now, the words that are spoken might also be charged with supernatural power, either from God or the demons, and then fulfilled as a result of that power. Now, it may or may not be the intention of the person who utters the curse that these harmful consequences should follow. And the person saying these things may not necessarily believe in the power of curses, or even that such things exist. Indeed, he might not even know that he's uttered a curse, and that's frequently the case. And tragically, we often see this when a parent or a teacher says words, negative words, which have an ongoing effect on the person to whom or about whom they're said. And that's not just psychological. It's not just that, oh well, the person was upset by it and it reduced their confidence and that's why it had an effect. No, of course that's part of it at a simple level, but that's not what I'm speaking of. I'm speaking of these people's words having an effect which goes well beyond that, and which goes on for decades or in that person's life. Now, even as adults, many people are still blighted by negative or belittling words which were spoken over them in childhood, which continue to ring in their ears and to shrink them and to even to cripple them. Sometimes it is something that's said by someone who had no idea of the terrible harm that their words would cause. It might have been said hastily or even in jest, but it's still said. And a curse also, it need not necessarily be about anything that you might classify as spiritual. It could relate to anything at all. The operative point is that a curse has the power to affect that person, whether in relation to their happiness or their marriage or their career, their finances, their health, their fertility, and so on. All sorts of things. It's not just what you would, by convention, classify as, speech marks, spiritual things. All sorts of things are affected by curses and cursing words. Okay, well, let's look at this. Who can utter a curse? Who, what kind of person can do so? Now, the ability to utter a curse is not limited to witches or other occult practitioners, although of course they do it. The fact is that anybody can do it. Anybody can utter a curse, and virtually all of us have done so, whether we realize it or not. And what's more, and this may surprise many people, even God himself curses people. I mean, that just saying that will surprise many, but the truth is that God is responsible for more curses than any other person, because he does it on such a huge scale. Isaiah speaks of this, and he confirms that most of the earth is under God's curse because of our sins and transgressions. He deals with this in Isaiah 24, verse 5 and 6. It says, "The earth lies polluted under its inhabitants, for they have transgressed the laws, violated the statutes, broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore a curse devours the earth, and its inhabitants suffer for their guilt. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are scorched, and few men are left." Now, the most famous curse of all that God uttered was at the fall of man, Adam and Eve. And that was when he cursed Adam and Eve and all their descendants because of their sin. And he even cursed the ground itself and the whole earth, such that now farming and gardening are to some extent hard labour rather than a complete pleasure. And I can testify to that in all the weeding I have to do and the different tasks I have to do out in the garden with the plants and shrubs and flowers and so forth. It's a much harder job for me than it was for Adam at the beginning in the Garden of Eden. But also much later, Moses also set out an array of specific curses which God would bring upon the Jewish people if they failed to listen to his voice and to obey his commands. And these are particularly dealt with in Deuteronomy chapter 28, but also look in Leviticus chapter 26 and you'll see them. So instead of just bypassing these, instead of closing your eyes as you drive by at 70 miles an hour and not notice these things, slow your car down and look closely out of the window as you drive by these verses, looking closely at them. Slow right down, look at them, take them seriously. Ask yourself, why has God put all this in the Bible? Why is God spending so much time talking about a thing which I'm assuming is imaginary, or non-existent, or trivial, or unimportant, or old-fashioned, or doesn't mean anything anymore? Why is it in the Bible? Ask yourself those questions, not only about this, but about dozens of other things that so many of us are assuming to be unimportant or not even thinking about at all. Okay, well, let's look at Deuteronomy 28, verse 15, because this begins a lengthy section which deals with curses. So it says here, "But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God, or be careful to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you this day, then all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you." Now there are then, in Deuteronomy chapter 28, there then follow another 53 verses, because there are 54 verses in total within Deuteronomy 28 which deal with curses. And prior to that there are 14 verses that deal with the blessings. But let's look at the curses firstly. So those verses that follow on, the 53 following verses, I'm not going to go through them here, but please look at them in Deuteronomy 28 and from verse 15 onwards, right the way through to the end of that chapter, and I think verse 68 it finishes at. So look at them for yourself and just weigh them up. Why are they there? Why is God taking them seriously? Why is Moses taking them seriously? So there are too many of them to list here, but look at the kind of things that they speak of. But note also that those curses are preceded in that same chapter by a series of blessings which God also says will come upon the Jewish people if they do listen to him and if they do obey his commands. And those are listed in particular in verses 3 to 14. But this is how they are introduced, the blessings are introduced in verses 1 and 2. And it says, "And if you obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, which I command you this day, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you, if you obey the voice of the Lord your God." Now, the thing is, why would we take the word blessing and assume that it means something, that it's real, that it's significant, that it has power? Why would we assume that God genuinely does bless people and can still do so? He's still capable of it. It's still a real thing. It's still something we want and take seriously. Why would we ask God to bless us or bless our children if blessings aren't real? If blessings aren't an unimaginary thing, you know, if blessings are a real thing rather than imaginary? Well, plainly, we all think that blessings are real. Well then, if that's the case, why are we assuming that curses are not real, that curses are imaginary but blessings are real? When God speaks of blessings, he's being literal. When he's talking about curses, he's being non-literal. Why are we assuming that? Or why are so many people assuming that? Now, the grim list of curses that are set out in Deuteronomy 28, verses 15 to 68, are graphically described, and they are pretty grisly. But the blessings are also equally specific, and the history of the Jewish people for the past 3,500 years since the law of Moses was given, they show the outworking of both the blessings and the curses. It's plain as day to look at, and you see the way that God raised the Jews up and also how he brought the Jewish people down, depending on the level of their obedience or disobedience to him. And there are also many other curses that God has spoken at other times, not just in Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26. And those are also operating and continuing to operate even today. Now, a curse that comes from God himself is essentially, it's usually a statement or a pronouncement by him as to what will happen to a person if they do something which he has forbidden, or if they fail to do something which he has commanded. But more to the point, such a curse is what he himself will do to that person, or which he will cause to happen to them as a consequence of that disobedience. Now, the outworking and the fulfillment of the curses are inevitable, because it's God who spoke them. Let's take this verse from Jeremiah, in which Jeremiah tells us that we are cursed if we trust in man, or if we trust in our own flesh, or in anyone else's flesh. So it says in Jeremiah 17, verse 5, "Thus says the Lord, cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength, whose heart turns away from the Lord." And we see also in Zechariah that a curse is sent out upon all who steal or lie, and it says that they will be cut off. Moreover, it says that that curse will even enter the house of the liar or the thief and remain with them as it takes effect and exerts its influence over them. So however you might choose to define or imagine or visualize such a thing, the point is that this is a reality. This is what God is saying will happen. And it says in Zechariah 5, verses 1 to 4, "Again I lifted my eyes and saw, and behold, a flying scroll. And he said to me, 'What do you see?' I answered, 'I see a flying scroll. Its length is 20 cubits, and its breadth 10 cubits.' Then he said to me, 'This is the curse that goes out over the face of the whole land. For everyone who steals shall be cut off henceforth according to it, and everyone who swears falsely," that means lies, "shall be cut off henceforth according to it. I will send it forth, says the Lord of hosts, and it shall enter the house of the thief and the house of him who swears falsely by my name, and it shall abide in his house and consume it, both timber and stones." And so the point is, God is sending out this thing, this this declaration, this statement, and then it's empowered in this way by whatever means it happens. The point is that it happens. The precise mechanism, the precise working of it, I don't entirely understand how God brings it about. But the point is, he brings it about. Now, I don't entirely understand how my engine works in my car. I don't entirely understand how the microwave works in the kitchen, but I know that it works. Now, why would I refuse to take seriously or believe in the internal combustion engine or the microwave or the dishwasher? Why would I refuse to believe in those things? Because I don't understand how they work. In fact, I think I understand curses a great deal better than I understand my car, to put it mildly. And so the thing is, the mere fact we don't entirely understand how a thing works is not a basis for us to disbelieve in it, or to refuse to look at it, or refuse to take it seriously. We need to take it seriously and endeavour to try to understand it as well as we can. But even in the absence of a complete understanding, we need to take it seriously and take it as seriously as God tells us to take it. And I think he's telling us to take it pretty seriously. So also Malachi, he speaks in similar terms, the prophet Malachi, of the curse that God sent out upon those priests who did not listen to him, to God, and who did not give glory to God's name. It says in Malachi 2, verses 1 and 2. And now, O priests, this command is for you. If you will not listen, if you will not take it to heart to give honour to my name, says the Lord of hosts, then I will send the curse upon you, and I will curse your blessings. Indeed, I have already cursed them, because you do not lay it to heart. Now that's God speaking through the prophet Malachi, and he's saying that he's going to curse these people. Now, why would we not take God seriously? Why would we not believe him that he's going to do that? And also, why would we assume, even if we are going to believe in these things, why would we assume that that's something that's unique to those people at that time, and this is something that God no longer does, and that we can safely ignore and forget all about? There's just simply no basis for doing either of those things. Okay, well, Malachi also speaks of how God curses those who robbed him by failing to give their proper tithes and offerings. Now that was how financial giving was arranged under the law of Moses. Although our duty to give now, to give financially, is expressed very differently now that we're in the church age. We're to give generously. We're not meant to give tithes and offerings in the way that is spoken of here in the law of Moses. But that's not the point. The operative point is that this is what happened to those who failed to give properly and generously under the Mosaic covenant when tithing still applied. We're not talking about tithing here, we're talking about the curse that comes from failing to obey the law of Moses during the time when it was in operation. It's no longer in operation. The law of Moses ceased when Jesus died. So, but anyway, let's focus on this point about curses. It says in Malachi 3, verses 8 to 10, "Will man rob God? Yet you are robbing me. But you say, how have we robbed you? In your tithes and contributions, you are cursed with a curse, for you are robbing me, the whole nation of you. Bring the full tithe into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and thereby put me to the test, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open the windows of heaven for you, and pour down for you a blessing, until there is no more need." Now, that specific curse for failing to give financially in accordance with the law of Moses doesn't apply to us today. But that's not the point. Other curses do apply, and we can still be affected by those. And therefore, if we have any common sense at all, we will choose willingly, voluntarily, to live in such a way as to make ourselves eligible to receive God's blessings, and so as to avoid his curses, to avoid those coming into operation in our lives. Now, some people might recoil, and in fact they do recoil, from the very idea that a Christian could ever be affected by a curse that God has spoken. But to me, it's self-evident that we can be affected by the curses that he's spoken, and that we can be affected in almost as many ways as an unbeliever can. For example, God has put in place a law, or you could call it a binding principle, whereby anyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and anyone who humbles himself will be exalted. Now, you could think of those two statements that Jesus made as being a fixed law that God has woven into the fabric of the whole universe. Life operates on the basis of these words that Jesus has spoken. Or alternatively, you could choose to see these words that Jesus has spoken as being both a curse and a blessing, depending on what we decide to do. Now, here's the passage, a brief point from Matthew 23, verse 12. It says, "Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted." Now, that is a statement by Jesus himself, and he says the word whoever. Now, it doesn't mean whoever, brackets, except, unless, on the other hand, not counting these. There aren't a bunch of exceptions to this. It just says whoever, and that means all of us. So if a non-Christian exalts himself, he'll be humbled. If a Christian exalts himself, he'll be humbled. It doesn't matter who you are, if you exalt yourself, you'll be humbled. That's a curse, essentially. You could describe it as such. Alternatively, if you humble yourself, you'll be exalted. Now, that will happen if a person is an unbeliever or if they're a believer, if they're saved or if they're unsaved, because it's a law of the universe. It's a law like the law of gravity. The law of gravity applies to non-Christians and to Christians equally. And the law of expressed by Jesus there in Matthew 23:12 about exalting and humbling yourself applies to all of us. So if you choose to ignore Jesus' words and you choose to exalt yourself by boasting and pride and self-importance or self-exaltation, then God is obligated by his own words to humble you. He's required to do so because he has spoken. That's what he said he will do, and therefore he will do it. Otherwise he would not be being true to himself and to his own word. So therefore, if God was to humble you, he'd have to move you lower down in response to your own exalting of yourself. Now, that, I would say, is an example of a curse in operation today. And that was spoken by Jesus in Matthew's Gospel, and it's in operation now. So a negative outcome then is occurring because of what God said and because of what you did to bring yourself within its scope. So if you were to step off of a wall or a tall building or something, or out of a window, the law of gravity would come into operation in relation to you. Why would it do so? Because God has put the law of gravity into effect, and you would bring yourself within its scope, within its ambit, by stepping out of that window or stepping off that wall or off that building. You would then suddenly find yourself subject to the law of gravity in a very real and meaningful way. So conversely, if you were to choose to humble yourself, then the blessing will operate instead. And God has said, Jesus has said, that anyone who humbles themselves will be exalted. So therefore God, in accordance with his own word, will find some means over some period of time by which he will exalt you. And he said that's just what he'll do, and I would regard that as a blessing. And what we therefore should do, if we have any sense, is put ourselves in line to become eligible for that blessing by choosing to humble ourselves, and to seek to avoid becoming subject to that curse by choosing not to exalt ourselves. That's what a wise, sensible person would do. Now, there's another very similar law, or if you want to call it this, a curse, if you prefer calling it that. And this likewise affects us all, whether we're Christians or not. And this is called the law of sowing and reaping. The Bible doesn't call it the law of sowing and reaping, but by convention it's called that, and I call it that. And it means that God has decreed that a person's own actions and decisions, whether good or evil, will later, in due course, come back upon themselves. Now, Apostle Paul speaks of this in Galatians chapter 6, verse 7. He says, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap." Now, this law is just as real and just as tangible as the law of gravity, and this law is stated by Paul, but he's speaking under God's inspiration, and it's therefore what God is saying. And again, it applies to us all, whether we're saved or unsaved, and therefore, whatever we do, whether good or evil, selfish or unselfish, obedient or disobedient, it will inevitably bear fruit of its own kind in our lives, and then we'll be made to reap that fruit in our own lives, whether it's good or bad. So if we do evil, we will inevitably reap a harvest of evil. Not necessarily that same day or the following day. It might be 10 years later. But you will reap it. It will come. And if at the absolute fallback position, it will come in the next life. It will come after death. Now that will pursue us wherever we go. So if that fruit that we are bearing, the outworking of this statement that Paul makes under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, the outworking of that statement of the law of sowing and reaping, as we call it, will pursue us wherever we go. You could go and live in Guatemala or Timbuktu. You could go and right the way around the world and live on the other side of the globe. This would pursue you, and it would take effect and come into operation there at the South Pole where you've gone to live. But if we do good, we'll reap a harvest of good. And again, it will pursue you wherever you go. And so, it can be seen as an unbreakable law of the universe. But again, it's also legitimate to view the law of sowing and reaping as both a curse and a blessing, depending on what you choose to do, and therefore the effect that it has upon you. Now, we've just looked at some examples of curses and also of blessings that have come from God himself. However, both curses and blessings can also be spoken by human beings. And what's more, they can speak these in their own right, not only on God's behalf, not only speaking what God has told them to say, like a prophet might do, but on their own account, just saying words of their own that they choose to say. And furthermore, curses and blessings can be spoken by any of us, whether we're Christians or not, and whether we believe in the power of curses or blessings or not. And we shall look at some examples later in this talk and in coming talks of how that might operate, and of curses that were uttered in particular by characters in the Bible, and the negative consequences that flowed from the things they said. So the key point, however, is that anybody can utter a curse, not just these people who were in the Bible. And we don't need to have any special position or title in order to do so. Neither do we need to have any knowledge or understanding of what we're doing, or of the effect that our words will have. And therefore, it's all the more vital that we begin to take this whole subject seriously and to gain a proper understanding of how it all operates. And that will help us to avoid cursing other people without even realizing that we're doing it. And it will also help us to realize what's going on when other people curse us, and what we can do about that in order to defend ourselves. So let's look at self-imposed curses, by which a person speaks a curse over himself, even if they don't realize that they're doing so. This is just one aspect of a curse, where it's directed towards yourself. And it's one of the commonest forms of a curse, actually. So the person curses themselves, usually without even being aware that they're doing so, and without having any belief or expectation that it will ever take effect. And an example of this in the Bible is Rebekah, the wife of Isaac and the mother of Jacob and Esau. Now, she spoke a curse over herself, probably without having any idea of the seriousness of what she was saying. And I'll tell the story here. The account begins when Isaac tells Esau that he wants to give him Isaac his blessing before he dies. And Isaac's blessing before he dies. So it's the blessing of Isaac upon Esau. He wants to give it to him before he dies. And then he sends Esau out to hunt for game, so that they can eat together before Isaac gives Esau Isaac's blessing. And we read this in Genesis 27, verses 1 to 4. It says, "When Isaac was old, and his eyes were dim, so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, 'My son.' And he answered, 'Here I am.' He said, 'Behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and prepare for me savory food such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, that I may bless you before I die.'" Now, Isaac's wife Rebekah heard all of this, but she favoured and preferred Jacob, and she wanted him to receive the blessing instead of Esau. So she quickly thinks of a scheme by which Isaac can be tricked into giving that blessing to Jacob. So she tells Jacob to go out and get two goats from the herd, which is just nearby, and then she'll quickly cook them, and Jacob can take the food through to Isaac and pretend to be Esau so as to be given the blessing that Isaac wanted to give to Esau. So Genesis 27, verses 5 to 10, it says, "Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, 'I heard your father speak to your brother Esau. Bring me game and prepare for me savory food that I may eat it and bless you before the Lord before I die. Now therefore, my son, obey my word as I command you. Go to the flock and fetch me two good kids that I may prepare from them savory food for your father, such as he loves, and you shall bring it to your father to eat, so that he may bless you before he dies.'" Now Jacob was anxious about this scheme that Rebekah came up with, and he feared that his father Isaac would discover the trick and then curse him rather than bless him. But this is when Rebekah speaks these fateful words by which she then curses herself. And to be more precise about it, she redirects a curse from Jacob onto herself. And she urges Jacob to go ahead with and do what she said. And she says, "Upon me be your curse." So, in Genesis 27, 11 to 13, it says, "But Jacob said to Rebekah his mother, 'Behold, my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall seem to be mocking him, and bring a curse upon myself and not a blessing.' His mother said to him, 'Upon me be your curse, my son. Only obey my word, and go, fetch them to me.' So Jacob went ahead, and Isaac was deceived, and the blessing was given to Jacob." Now, this blessing was the one that is due to the firstborn son. So don't confuse it with the birthright, which Jacob had already induced Esau to sell to him for a bowl of soup. That's already been dealt with, and that flippant transaction, which greatly angered God, was already in the past. That was Esau's own fault. Now this second episode has to do with the blessing that Isaac, as the father, wanted to give to his firstborn, and it's this that Jacob has stolen from Esau by this deception. So before we see what happened to Rebekah due to her self-imposed curse, let's look at how the blessing was given to Jacob and how it couldn't be taken back afterwards. Now that's significant in itself, and it shows the power that words have, whether to bless or to curse. They can be very difficult and sometimes even impossible to undo. And that's why we need to be extremely careful what we say, especially to and about our children. And this is what happened when Jacob's trick was discovered. It's in Genesis 27, verses 30 to 37. "As soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, when Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of Isaac his father, Esau his brother came in from his hunting. He also prepared savory food and brought it to his father. And he said to his father, 'Let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that you may bless me.' His father Isaac said to him, 'Who are you?' He answered, 'I am your son, your firstborn, Esau.' Then Isaac trembled violently and said, 'Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? And I ate it all before you came, and I have blessed him. Yes, and he shall be blessed.' When Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry, and said to his father, 'Bless me, even me also, O my father.' But he said, "Your brother came with guile, and he has taken away your blessing." Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing." Then he said, "Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" Isaac answered Esau, "Behold, I have made him your lord, and all his brothers. I have given to him for servants, and with grain and wine I have sustained him. What then can I do for you, my son?" So Esau was angry when he realized what Jacob had done, and he resolves to kill Jacob. It says in Genesis 27:41. Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." As a result of this threat or statement by Esau, Jacob has to flee, or otherwise Esau would have killed him. So Jacob stays away for 20 years, and Rebekah never saw him again. Now she died while he was still hiding from Esau, and that in itself must have been a torment to her, because Jacob was her favourite son. See, when these things are in the Bible, you've got to imagine it, picture it. Imagine yourself in this situation. Imagine how Rebekah feels when Jacob leaves suddenly. He has to flee from the home, and she doesn't know where he's going, and she never sees him again. Imagine how that would make a mother feel, especially in relation to her favourite son, which she ought not to have been, by the way. She shouldn't have had a favourite. That was wrong of her, and that's one of the things that enabled this curse to come upon her. She was acting wrongly in having a favourite. That should not have happened. Anyway, more of that later. So the other thing is, she actually dies while Jacob is still away hiding from Esau, so she never sees him again. And despite him being her favourite son, which is the very reason why she suggested the trick in the first place. Now at some later point she speaks to her husband. The Bible records this. It's after Jacob has gone, and she says, "I am weary of my life." Now that was part, what she was expressing there was part of the outworking of the curse which she had brought upon herself, or rather which she had redirected towards herself by her own foolish words, and it was already taking effect. And so in Genesis 27:46 she says this, "Then Rebekah said to Isaac, 'I am weary of my life because of the Hittite women. If Jacob marries one of the Hittite women, such as these, one of the women of the land, what good will my life be to me?'" So she's worried. She doesn't know what's happening to Jacob, who he's marrying. She's imagining how old he must be now. Who is he married? Has he married someone? Is it a Hittite woman? Has he married a Canaanite? And so on. She's fretting about him. Can you imagine just how much that must have really taken over her life? And she's lain awake at night worrying about him. But so in addition to missing Jacob, which must have been terrible in itself, she was also anxious as to what would become of him and whom he'd marry. Would he marry a pagan? Now, actually, unbeknownst to her, he'd married Rachel and Leah, the daughters of Rebekah's brother Laban. But Rebekah wouldn't have known that, because Jacob couldn't come back and visit her to give her news or to let her know where he was. Otherwise, Esau would have killed him. He'd have come over to Laban's place and killed him. So therefore, Rebekah spent her final years, the final 20 years, or at least part thereof, in a weariness of regret and torment. And she also died young. And she died before her husband, which is unusual in itself. But in particular, she died before Jacob came back. Now, she was experiencing the outworking of the curses which would otherwise have come upon Jacob. Now firstly, there would be Esau's own curses, which he must have uttered himself against Jacob. Those would be redirected towards Rebekah. And secondly, there would be God's own curse, which comes upon all liars. That would be redirected towards Rebekah. Both of these curses, and others too, were redirected towards her as a result of her own words. by which she had declared that they would come upon her, and she even asked for them to do so, rather than be upon Jacob. And sadly, we never hear of Rebekah again after this, and that must in large part be due to her own foolish cursing words. Okay, well, I'll stop at this talk at that point.